What's going on, everyone? Thanks for stopping by my podcast, Chasing the Hook, Ironworker Stories and More. The only podcast where we'll sit down with the old timers and let them tell the stories of the old days. We will also talk history, traditions, and what the future holds for us. So don't be a Joe and stick around.
Let's get into the introduction, Bill. Your name and your book number, and then how you became an ironworker, or how'd you get into it?
My name is Bill Holmes. My book number is 732555. I came out of Philadelphia, local 401, Structure and Ornamental Ironworkers. When I got out of the Navy, my father was an ironworker, and my father-in-law is an ironworker. One out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one out of Camden, New Jersey. And so I started off, I was a police officer for a couple months, no money in that. And so they talked me into getting into the ironworkers, and I was a spoiled kid.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I didn't like it. Too physical, too hard. But eventually I saw an old man get out of a car and stretch and go to work, and I thought, It was a different time. These ironworkers that when I went in were, I don't know, 18 years out of World War II. They were a little loco, but most ironworkers are. And they were just tough men, scary. You know, they told you to hop, you hopped. It was just a different time. There was no OSHA. That didn't come in until 1972, I believe, under Nixon. But no OSHA. So to pick up an oxygen bottle and throw it on your shoulder and go up a ladder to the second floor to hook it up, that's what you did. They told you to do it. You got started in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, local 401, which is a structural and ornamental local. They had no rods. They have a rod local. They have a riggers local. And I believe they have the Stone Derrickman's local, but I was in the structural local.
Structural local. So you went in. So was there an apprenticeship or at that time, or was it just you went? I mean, they called it an apprenticeship. You're basically going to work, right?
It was an apprenticeship. It was on, I believe it was Tuesday and Thursday night at 7 o'clock till 10 o'clock. So you get up in the morning at 6 and go to work. And if you happen to work, you know, 30, 35 miles away from home, you didn't have enough time to leave work after work at 4:30, go home, have dinner, and go back to class. So you left from work and went right to school. So on those days, you got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you didn't get home until 11 o'clock at night. And they didn't have the instructions like we have. They taught us how to tie some knots. They showed us about derricks,
did they have like a mock-up or like how, or just like a, was it all like book work? I mean, did you have any like, you know, kind of like today you have some hands-on kind of like little mock-up things that you can do?
No, we had no books. They had a mock-up of a crane. I saw it, but I never did anything with it.
Yeah.
It was just a assistant business agent that would come in and tell you, you know, the first thing you do in the morning is you hook up the oxygen bottles, and you're the first one out of the hall, out of the shack, and you're the last one in the shack. You know, you keep your mouth shut and do what the foreman tells you.
So that's been around since the beginning of your time is, you know, setting up the bottles and, you know, obviously making sure you're out of the shack, making sure you're getting the journeyman's, getting things ready for the journeyman to go to work.
Yeah. And there was a lot of injuries on the job at that time, a lot of deaths. I witnessed three myself.
Wow.
My connecting partner got killed 2 feet in front of me. A boom came down on him.
With that being said, though, Bill, do you remember what your first job was? Do you remember what?
Yeah. My first job was pulling up sheets on a well wheel. And after an hour and a half, I couldn't open my hands. They cramped up. So I'd have to put my hand against my leg and force my fingers open to grab onto that rope and pull that sheet up, because I was a milquetoast. I was just a young.
Yeah, I can imagine. I still remember, you know, just like learning the tools, you know, you're holding onto your spud and all that. And then you wake up the next day and your hands are, I mean, I remember just trying to like get my hands open. I know exactly what you're talking about. So like on that first job, what were some of the kind of the guys that you were working with? I mean, do you remember like in those early days, some of the, like your mentors or like some of the guys that kind of took you under their wing and, you know, kind of showed you the ropes?
I had a real good foreman on my first job, older fella, not as old as me now, but he was probably 60. And he was very, very good. The other guys were just kind of crazy, drinking. You know, I mean,
so that was obviously a big part of ironworking in the day, right? Is, you know, was that all day or was that just kind of like on breaks? You know, guys would, you know, sip the whiskey bottle, that kind of thing, or was that just,
I was the punk that would go get the coffee orders, and some guys would want coffee, some guys would want a bottle of booze, you know?
Gotcha.
And they put it in their bag and go to work. I never saw any of them get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, but now that I think back on it, they were in a lot of physical pain. And this probably took the edge off. And they were in debt. We didn't make the money that they're making now. When I came in, a journeyman was making $4.15 an hour. And apprentices got half of that.
With that being said, though, Bill, like, what's your, like, when you were growing up as a kid, obviously you guys, your family was union, right? I mean, was that just preached to you as a young kid growing up?
Absolutely not.
No.
I thought that a union hall was a dark, dirty concrete or stone building in Philadelphia with a bunch of guys standing around out front that needed to shave. It was a criminal organization. I had no idea. And that's why I believe with all my heart and soul that unionism should be taught in the schools just like math or science. Let these young people know what it was, how it started, and how many guys suffered, men and women, to get what we've got today. They don't know. It's kind of a hidden secret that they don't want anybody to know about. And it's not right. They should know.
Absolutely. I mean, as being an organizer with Local 29, I hear it from those guys all the time. I mean, they're, you know, told just all this bullshit that is not even true. And then like when you actually like show them proof, you know, it blows their mind. And it's not just, you know, the wages, but it's like, you know, guys that I've organized and they start seeing how the union works and what the brotherhood is and all that is just, it blows their mind that they've been lied to their whole lives.
Yeah, and a lot of people just won't believe it. They just won't believe it. They've been taught differently. I went out on a couple of jobs, and there was people out there working for right to work, and they were making like $5 an hour less than we were making. And we told them, hey, look, if you come with us, we can get you an extra $5 an hour. And they said, what we're making is plenty.
When you were working, you know, your early years and stuff like that, what was the opinion towards guys that were non-union, or like if was organizing a big thing back in those days? Like if you brought an organized guy in, how did you treat that person? You know what I mean?
Didn't treat them very good.
Yeah.
Like I say, these journeymen that were the lead journeymen, the guys that were 50 years old, they had fought in World War II.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't take no shit from nobody. And, so, you know, you see today we go out on pickets and we give information out and we try to teach people that what we're doing is for the good of the nation, for the good of the working man. They didn't think that way. If a truck came in, they'd turn the truck over on its side. I was there. I saw it.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it, but I saw it. I wasn't up front. I was way in the back because I was scared.
Yeah.
But, no, they were a different breed of cat.
Did you get to experience quite a few strikes and pickets in your early?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know that was a big thing back in. That was where all the power was.
Yeah. Yeah. We struck all the time.
Yeah.
All
I mean, the time. That's why a union was so big back then, right? Just because you guys had that power.
Well, today, if you look at somebody cross-eyed, they're going to sue you.
Yeah.
They're going to sue the local. They're going to sue the district council. They're going to sue the international. That didn't happen back then. It was a different time. And, you know, well, when I first came out here, 1979, I was on a couple pickets. And the first picket I went on, I was shocked because there was ironworkers out there with their wives and their kids. And I thought, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know? That didn't happen in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, when you went out there with your ball peen hammers and your spud wrenches. And
so it was going to be physical. You knew going in it was going to be physical. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was scary.
Yeah.
Not that that was right. I'm not saying that that was right, but I'm saying that that got results.
Exactly. In your experience with that, did you obviously saw people get hurt? And I mean, was it, did you ever see? Yeah, it's,
yeah,
I can only imagine. I mean, you're bringing spud wrenches and ball peen hammers. Somebody's getting hurt.
Well, you know, a truck pulls up on a job with a load of iron on it. And then once you get through the line and the picket ain't going to move.
Yeah.
So next thing you know, they're grabbing the truck driver and pulling him out of the cab. And he's swinging and fighting. And they're, he ain't got a chance because it's like ants on a sugar cube, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, I saw a lot of that. Yeah.
That's, we're ways away from that these days, obviously. But,
and that's a good thing.
It is.
It's a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
The international was put in a tough spot. They were given a choice of continuing down the road of fighting with the federal government or sign an agreement that we would not strike. And so they signed the agreement, put a lot of guys to work. It was not a wrong thing. It was just a totally different thing than what people are used to.
Yeah.
At least what the ironworkers were used to.
Yeah.
And we were nuts, but the rod busters were nuttier.
Oh, I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Yeah, that's kind of, at least in my experience, you know, that's kind of, you know, a lot of rod busters that I've worked with, they're just, you know, I'm not, you know, I love structural part of it, but the rod busting is where I was taught to work. I mean, it was hard work every day. And it was like, you're not standing around by any means. You know what I mean? There's no downtime. It's go, 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 you know?
Yeah. I can remember after about.
What was it like working in those days? I mean, just not being tied off and you know, one move, you know, that's your life, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, that still kind of happens today, but I mean, that feeling of not everything you're doing is not tied off. You don't have something behind you dragging on you. Yeah, what was that like?
It was just every day. It was just an everyday thing. You walk the iron. If you can't walk the iron, get another job. If you can't walk the iron, coon the iron.
So the old timers didn't give a shit about that. Like, you know, some people just aren't, they're more comfortable cooning the iron, obviously, but did you get shit for cooning the iron back in the day?
Yeah. Yeah. They tell you to stand up and walk like a man.
Yeah.
And we had a 6-foot rope lanyard tied to your tool belt. And they said, well, if you're scared, tie off with that. Well, I went to work for American Bridge and they immediately cut that off.
Did they?
They said, don't depend on that because that's, you're going to shit right out of that belt. Depend on yourself if you can't do it. You know, so I went in a hole.
Yeah,
I was working at Boeing and we were working up on the side of the building, putting sheets up, working off of an aluminum pick. And there was me and my partner. I don't remember his name, but I remember he was a big guy. And the foreman yelled up to us and he said, hey, get that last bag of insulation up and we're calling it a day. And we both looked at each other and walked over to the middle of the pick and kind of gave a little hop. Yay, you know?
Yeah.
That pick ripped in half and we went flying 40 feet in the air.
Wow.
We were fortunate. We landed on boxes of insulation.
Wow.
So we didn't get hurt. And that's got a lot to do with it if you're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, some guys just aren't lucky.
Yeah. Like you said, you were, you know, your partner was killed right in front of you. I mean, what was that like? I mean, like, obviously, you guys were hanging iron. I mean, what was the day like? Was the day going good? You guys were getting some pieces up?
We were done.
Oh, you were done, huh?
Piece of iron, and we came down. It still haunts me. It still haunts me.
Yeah, I bet.
I don't want to think about it, you know, but
yeah.
The foreman said, don't do nothing. I'm going to the shack, make a phone call, get a couple trucks in here to take these boom sections away. And he went to the shack and an operator boomed the crane down. And they told me, get under and knock those pins out, kid. I didn't know. So I got under and I hit the one pin. It flew out.
Yeah.
I went over. I hit the other pin. It went out about a quarter of an inch. They tapped it back in. I hit it again. It went out about a quarter of an inch. It tapped it back in. And my partner said, get out of there, kid. I'll get it. He yeah. jumped under there, hit it. The pin flew out. The boom.
Came down.
Went in half and crushed and killed him.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, I mean, I can only imagine what that was like, Bill. You know what I mean?
It was part of it, you know. I mean, you understood the dangers you were in. This is not a easy job. This is a dangerous job. This was before OSHA. This was before any kind of safety. The company, if you went to work for American Bridge or Bethlehem Steel, they had a 2-hour course in the morning telling you about safety, you know, wear glasses and wear a hard hat. And that was about it.
Yeah.
But once you left the shack and you went out to the field, the foreman said, forget that.
Yeah.
We got a job to do, and this is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So is that what you kind of did in your early days, Bill? Did you do a lot of connecting in those days? Is that like, what did you prefer to do? I mean, obviously everybody wants to go to the connecting side, but did you know, it just all depend.
I wasn't that good of a connector. I'm short and stocky. Most of the connectors were taller, leaner,
yeah.
get around the iron better. I had no trouble walking around the iron, but I was basically a bolter up.
Bolter up?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I started there, and, you know, that's how I got comfortable was just doing that. It wasn't a rush, you know what I mean? You could learn pretty, you know, it gets you comfortable more easier, you know what I mean? Yeah.
There's a lot to learn.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. It was, yeah.
It really is. It sounds like it's easy, but there's a lot to learn.
Yeah. So I've always wanted to ask, like, back in those days, you know, like nowadays, Bill, like, you know, the connectors start hanging iron, then, you know, the bolt-up guys are getting bolted up, and then you start throwing deck. Is that how it worked back in those days, too? Or were they still using planks until they kind of got the building plumb and rigid and all that before you started putting the sheeting down?
They used planks until they were, like, four stories up.
Four stories.
And then they'd start sheeting.
Okay.
And there was usually 2 or 3 stories of planks.
Okay.
Below the connectors.
Okay.
And it was scary, man.
I bet.
It was scary.
Yeah.
And they'd tell you, like, well, don't be afraid of the planks. You can see the planks. Be afraid of the sheets, the decking.
Yeah.
Because if the decking sticks out too far over a beam and you step on that end, it's going to tilt and you're going to go in the hole.
Yep. Wow. So we were talking about, you know, you only made, you know, the journeymen were making $4 an hour back in those days, and apprentice made half of that. Did you guys, how did the scale work back then? I mean, was there a raise? I mean, how did the contract work? Did you guys have benefits? I mean, what was your benefits like?
There was no pension. I believe the International had a $50 a month pension at age 65, I believe.
Okay.
They had some kind of a little pension. The locals didn't have any pension. We did have a vacation, 10 cents an hour.
10 cents an hour.
And and you got that. There was a 2-month period in the summer, I believe it was July and August, that you could cash your vacation stamps in. You got a stamp.
Okay.
And if you had to be there in person to do that.
Okay.
So if you worked in California and you happened to be working in Philadelphia for 5 or 6 months, you never got that vacation money.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
I don't know where it went, but they didn't get it because they had to be there in person to get it. So if you got $300 coming or $200 coming, you're not going to go from Los Angeles to Philadelphia to pick up $200.
Yeah, exactly.
$250 to get it.
Exactly. So... I mean, as you move through your career, Bill, you know, you kind of obviously you start learning more, you know, you become a journeyman and all that. Do you feel like I've always heard, like, once you turn out, until you're about 10 years in, that's when you start really understanding ironwork, and you know, you're semi-decent at about 10 years. Do you agree with that, or do you see that as a – do you look at it a different way?
No, that's about right. That's about right. At that point, you just don't give a damn anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is what I've got to do for the rest of my life. It sucks.
Yeah.
It's hard. You're working in terrible weather conditions. You're working with guys that, my God, some of them, oof, you know, you don't know if they can read and write, but they're bulls, they're gorillas.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's about right. About 10 years, you start saying like, well, this is it. And at that point, you start saying, I've got to protect myself.
Yeah.
And if you've got any kind of conscience at all, you look at the young apprentice there and you say, I got to try to help this kid too. See, when I was an apprentice, the journeyman would not help you at all.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No. Their idea was, hey, if I help this young kid, he's going to be as good as I am, and they're going to get rid of me and keep him because he's more physical and younger.
Yeah.
So they didn't help you at all, no.
Yeah.
But then for some reason, I don't know if it was just an age thing where the old military people from World War II had retired and we had younger men now that were in charge, but they took care of the apprentices more.
Started teaching them, like, you know, one of the big things that, like, Mark was my first foreman ever. And, you know, I remember him still that day bringing me and showing me the drawings and showing me how that being a superintendent, a foreman works, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which.
Well, you know, the old timers would say, make sure you stick your pant legs in your boots. Don't leave your pant legs outside your boot because it could get hung up.
Yeah.
And throw you in a hole.
So that started, you guys were doing that back in those days too.
Yeah. And you wear gauntlet gloves.
Yeah.
Tape them.
Yeah.
Because
so
if the hook gets caught in your glove, you're going up with it.
Yep.
And just things like that.
Did you guys, obviously, you wore the flat sole boots and all that, right?
Back
You wear Red Wings too? Or what boot did you like to wear?
I wore whatever boot I could afford.
Okay.
But I that's like with our gloves. We wore White Chief.
White Chief?
And they were a totally leather glove, top and bottom, with a gaunt, you know, with a cuff, with a gaunt cuff. And that's what we wore, because you could use them for bolting up. You could use them for connecting. You could use them for welding and for burning.
Oh, really?
The contractor didn't supply anything. If you work for a big company like, let's say, Bethlehem Steel or American Bridge, they'd issue you a tool belt.
Oh, they would?
Yeah.
Ah.
And most of the time, you kept them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, once you got laid off, you just walked off the job with the belt on.
Yeah, I mean, those are like prized now. I mean, everybody wants those.
I know. When I came out here, I think I had 3 sets.
Really?
And I gave them away.
Yeah.
To young guys that needed them. But, you know, you want to make sure that your spud wrench, if you're climbing a column, you want to make sure that when you stick that spud wrench in a hole and you sit on it, that it doesn't break.
Yeah.
That it doesn't bend. So
when you worked for Bethlehem, I know they issued hard hats like the Bullard. That's kind of where they started. Did you wear all that? Did you wear the Bullard back in those days when you were working for Bethlehem?
Yeah. And when I first started, not many guys wore hard hats.
Oh, yeah.
They just wore like I don't know what kind of hat it would be called, like a baseball cap.
Gotcha.
You
know?
Some of them would put newspaper in it. So if a bolt did come down, hit you on it.
Yeah,
you
had a little bit of padding. Yeah.
But then the big companies, like I say, American Bridge, they started issuing hard hats and making you wear hard hats. And of course, when OSHA come in, that was, you know, you had to have them.
Yeah.
And the best thing that happened to us was OSHA.
Yeah.
I mean, when it first came in, everybody said, screw OSHA. We don't need that. We're iron workers. We're tough guys. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I needed it.
Yeah.
You know, you try to climb a column with a bag full of bolts and a rope around you. You know, you get up to the top, you put those bolts in, and you drop the rope down and start pulling buckets of bolts up. And you got a choice between that and a scissor lift. You're going to take the scissor lift.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, the thinking on, like you just said, you know, fuck OSHA. I mean, obviously, that kind of tends to, as soon as something else is introduced into that makes us have to change. Obviously, we want to rebel against it, right? So I'm sure that was a huge thing, was rebelling against OSHA, right? Well,
when OSHA first came in, I mean, it was there, but it really didn't have any clout.
Okay.
You know, until the contractors started getting hit with fines.
Yeah.
And the contractor said, wait a minute, you know?
Yeah.
Well, if we go by what OSHA requires, it's going to take us 8 more days to finish this job. Or we can do what we're doing. And to find,
you want to be that, you know, that wildcat, you know, I've done it. We've all done it. I think, you know, even, you know, just, you know, at some point your yo-yo or your lanyard, just your beamers don't, you can't get to that next spot. So you got to cheat. You know what I mean? That's just kind of what we do.
We're risk takers.
Exactly. That's just part of it.
Yeah. Most ironworkers are risk takers. They push the envelope a little bit. But they're good at it.
Yep, absolutely.
So
yeah, so like in those early years, Bill, like you know, as soon as the ironworkers got on the job, they take over. That's just how it is. I mean, what was it like when the Connect and the Racing Gang first showed up, you know, on the job? What was it like back in those days?
The ironworkers were in charge. When the Racing Gang got there was basically some laborers, there may be a couple concrete finishers or concrete men, some operators, and 20 crazy ironworkers. I mean, these guys were frightening. I swear, I don't know how to put it any other way. They were very nice guys. They were kind. They'd give you the shirt off their back. And yet, if the local said, we need 2 cents an hour for vacation money, they'd say, no way, we're not going to give you no 2 cents an hour, work hard for that. But if you went up to them and said, hey, I need $2 for lunch, they'd all reach in their pocket and hand it to you.
Yeah.
So they're just, they were crazy.
So we took over shit as soon as, back in those days. I mean, I can only imagine what it was like back then as compared to now. I mean, you know, we get there and, you know, everybody just knows that we're here to hang iron and get the fuck out of the way.
Yeah. And, you know, in the summertime, I don't know about the wintertime, but I know in the summertime, if you were decking or if you were, no matter what you were doing, at 10 o'clock, you had a coffee break. At 2 o'clock, you had a beer break.
Okay.
You know, and they'd always have a chest full of ice and beer.
Nice.
And the guys would have a can of beer. Well, they stopped that.
Yeah.
Not that a can of beer is going to get you drunk.
Yeah.
But some guys didn't.
I mean, you worked on the Twin Towers. What was that like?
Put elevator fronts in.
Elevator fronts, huh?
Yeah. I don't know. It was just a job.
Just a job, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, so obviously.
A lot of people, a lot of congestion.
Yeah.
Just a job.
Just, so like, were the towers already erected?
No.
So you were just working below the, I mean.
Yeah.
What part did you show, where were they at when you showed up?
They were like about the 12th story.
12th story, huh? Yeah.
And I was there until about the 16th story.
16th story?
That's all. I was a boomer, you know?
Yeah.
And at the time, if you were a boomer and a local hand got laid off, then you as a boomer would get laid off. The local hand would get that job.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the way it is today. But that's the way it was then.
Yeah. So why did you – I mean, obviously, was there – in Philly, was there no work? I mean, was it
– Yeah.
That's kind of
– Yeah, there was
hard, always, or did you want to just boom out? You kind of just wanted to get away?
No. I went up with my father-in-law, and there were 6 of us in one room, you know, sleeping on the floor.
When it's actually being built, coming up to the job and seeing it. I mean, just what that experience was like.
Well, we took the subway, and it was just a big job.
Yeah.
But then I've been on some big jobs. I've been on the Salem Nuclear Power Plant in New Jersey. That was a big job. Yeah, I went down there. I went to Salem and took the welding test. And I was young. I was a welder, but I wasn't a crackerjack welder.
Yeah.
And they gave us a welding test. And I had been working in Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to go back to Minnesota because it was wintertime. And when I left, it was 70 below zero wind chill factor.
Yeah.
How we worked in that, I have no idea, but we did.
Yeah.
And I had to pass this welding test. And I did. I passed the welding test. So I was able to stay in Salem. And now I was a boomer.
Yeah.
Of course, Salem was out of Camden, New Jersey local. So when a local ham wanted a job, they would lay you off.
Yeah.
But being we were welders and they couldn't get anybody to pass the welding test, they made an exception for us.
Okay.
So I was able to stay there for a year.
Oh, nice, nice. So like that welding test, what was the welding like in those days? Obviously it was stick and things like that. I mean, what was the welding like the procedure and, you know, I mean,
well, it was the same test they give today, a 1-inch plate, vertical, horizontal, overhead. It was tough. It was tough. And they didn't have a iron worker check the welds. They had a pipe fitter check the welds.
Oh, really?
And the pipe fitters and the iron workers didn't get along real good. But they had to get somebody to pass these welding tests.
Yeah. I mean, was the welder this big, huge dinosaur machine? That's what I'm saying. Like, I see you just dragging lead, like just running leads because you can't drag that close to your point, right?
They were big machines, Lincolns, and they had a crank wheel on the front of them.
Oh, yeah.
That you would crank the heat up and down.
Yeah.
And when you got there, the first thing you would do is you'd take the leads off the machine. They had a welding class, but like I say, you know, you work 2 days a week, 3 hours each night. You can't learn much welding.
Yeah.
So they'd show you how to put the rod in the handle, you know, and tell you to start at the bottom and go up. Well, that's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, you can't start at the bottom and go up. Just make a big. So you didn't learn much welding. If you learn any welding, you learned it on your own. And there again, I was taught, and all of us were taught 70-18.
Yeah.
You know? And so we got good at 70-18.
I bet.
I'll tell you what, some of the 70-18 welds were picture perfect, and it was good for everything. Then they came up with the wire. I believe it was 211. I can't remember for sure if that was a number. But that ran nice.
Yeah.
It ran well. But then they found out that it was only good for iron up to 1/2 inch thick.
Yeah.
Well, that screwed everything up. Now they come up with, I believe it was 232.
Yep.
I still can't weld that crap.
Really?
Oh, no.
Oh, you'd much rather go to the stick, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that you can go faster, and that's all the contractor wants, speed.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's, that, yeah. But, What were the men like back in those days? I mean, obviously you said they're mean and tough and all that, but did you have a lot of partners that you worked with continuously? Did you like boom out with, you know, like a certain person or like how did
my brother, my brother was an iron worker. I worked with him most of the time. But there were other guys, you know, but, no, I boomed out with my brother.
Was there any like characters that like you know that you remember from those days? Like that, you know, just you know how you go on. There's some jobs you'll run in. There's just a guy that you always will remember. He's just
Yeah. There were guys who were funny. The funniest ones were the ones that had the dry sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know. But there was a bunch of them, and they were good men. That stick by your side.
Yeah.
They will stick by your side.
Was there a lot of fighting on the job between brothers? Yeah. I mean, or was it always with the other trades?
With the other trades.
Yeah.
I had a couple run-ins, but they weren't really fights, you know, like they were one punch.
Yeah.
And because the person that you were arguing with didn't think that it was going to go that far.
Obviously, like, you know, in these days, we call them lums, you know, things like that. People are just showing up to get a paycheck and not really being part of, you know, just being lazy, that kind of thing. Is that what you guys called those type of workers back in those days, as lums? Or what were some of the nicknames that you gave those kind of guys?
Drunks.
Drunks?
Yeah. They'd come into the job, hungover, you know, stagger out of their car, hungover, and we'd put them in the gang box until coffee break.
Yeah.
Let them out of coffee break. They were okay. Then went back to work.
Yeah. So you looked out after them. You weren't like, motherfuckering them. Yeah. You know,
out after them. Yeah. They were good guys.
Yeah.
They were alcoholics.
Yeah.
And we realized that that's a disease.
Yeah.
That's not something that they want. They're trying to either bury pain or bury memories, and they get drunk.
Yeah.
But they're good workers when they're sober.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a huge part even these days, Bill. I mean, obviously mental health is a big thing these days. You know, a lot of people are more aware of it and things like that. I can only imagine that's how people, obviously with pain and depression and all that, everybody, you know, a lot of people turn to the bottle.
I never even gave that a thought at 21,
yeah.
at 31, at 41. But at 79, I understand pain.
Yeah.
And to have to work with that every day.
Yeah.
Every day. You got to hide it somehow.
Yeah.
And they didn't have pain pills. They didn't have, at that time, some of the narcotics that the fellas are taking.
Yeah.
But they would hide it with alcohol.
Yeah, That's I've heard a lot of things, you know, about we have so many other things now that people are involved in. And, you know, that's another thing I'd like to make people aware of is if you need help, you need help, you know, ask for it. But you said, what made you decide to come out to Portland?
I was sitting in line in a car. And I have been working at the nuclear power plant in Salem, Oregon. And I was driving home. And the traffic there is unbelievable. Unbelievable. In the morning, going to work, four or five times people are blowing their horns at you and honking at you, shaking their fist at you. Just bumper to bumper all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And I was driving home.
This was in New Jersey, Bill? Or
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania?
Right on the New Jersey border.
Okay.
And I happened to look down, and there was a funeral going by me, slowly. And I saw the hearse go by, and I saw the widow in the back seat. And I looked back in the rearview mirror, and I thought, what a sap.
Yeah.
What a sap. Living in this country, and I thought, Jesus Christ, that's me. That's me sitting there, you know?
Yep.
And I went home and I told my wife, we got to get out of here. And she said, well, where do you want to go? I said, as far away from here as I can get. She said, well, try Washington State. I said, well, where the hell is it?
Yeah.
You know? And I said, okay. So I went to Len Mahoney, who was a vice president of the International, who happened to be a member of Local 401. And I asked him if he would write me a letter of introduction. And he said, certainly. So he wrote me two letters, one to Seattle and one to whom it may concern. And I had a cousin that lived in Portland. And so on the way to Washington, I stopped here and I went and saw my cousin. And I looked around and said, yeah, this is a pretty nice place.
Yeah.
So I come down to the hall and I gave the letter of introduction to Leroy Worley. And about a week later, they said, well, are you going to come into this member of this local or not? And I thought, Christ, I don't know, you know. I never thought it would happen that fast. He said, well, I need a dollar. So I gave him a dollar, and a couple weeks later, I had a card as a member of Local 29.
Wow. What was he like, Leroy Worley?
One of the best gentlemen I've ever met. I love the man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a good man. He did a lot for this local and a lot for the members. I got hurt at the skid modules in Tacoma. I hurt my back, and I was out of work for 6 months. And I was trying to get workman's compensation, and they were fighting me and fighting me and fighting me. So finally, I went to the business agent here, and I asked him, you know, I need some help. And he said, hey, look, kid, you're not going to get nothing from them. Just forget it.
Yeah.
I went home, and I sat there, and I cried.
Yeah.
And I thought, God, you know, I'm hurt. I'm really hurt. And so I said, I got to go see Leroy. And I went and saw Leroy. He was the general organizer, I believe. And I walked into the office, and he had met me once. I walked in and said, God damn, Bill Holmes, how you doing? I thought, man, this man knows who I am. He knows my name anyway. Yeah. And what can I do for you? And I told him. He said, wait a second. He picked up the phone and he called the trust. And he said, I got a man here who's hurt. I've got
that fear of, you know, you're hurt and you don't know what to do and all that, you know. And
I was collecting bottles to get money to buy milk for the baby.
Yeah.
That's how low it was.
I bet.
You know? And they owed me like, I don't know, $1,200.
Really?
And I couldn't get it. And with one phone call, Leroy got it.
You got it. How long did it take you to heal up, Bill, and get back to work?
A year? Yeah.
Wow. Did you go in the hole or did you?
No, I was putting a... I was putting acetylene bottle into a basket on the front of a forklift, and the forklift shifted, and a bottle of acetylene hit me in the back.
Wow.
And it didn't rupture a disc, but it...
Damn near.
Yeah. It hurt me.
Wow. I bet. Did you finish? Did that happen like early in the day or, you know?
I don't remember, but yeah. I finished the day.
And I bet waking up that next morning, it was really bad.
I tried to work for another 3 days, I think. And finally I said, hey, I can't do this.
Yeah. So, wow. So yeah, like, you know, that you brought up Leroy Worley. And I mean, what was the leadership other than like him in those days? Like when you first got here, was work, I mean, I know the 80s were just getting ready. Reagan was getting ready to get in there. And, you know, I've always heard that work wasn't the greatest in that time. What was it like in those days, like as far as like the leadership and getting work? And what was the work situation like in those days when you first got here?
Well, before I got here, I called ahead to find out if I come, can I get a job?
Yeah.
And I talked to Gordon Jensen.
Gordon.
Who was a dispatcher. And I think he was a...
That's Kevin Jensen's dad, right?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. But I talked with him, and he said, if you can get here within a week, I got a job for you. So we headed out, and he put me to work immediately.
Wow.
And one of the first things he said to me was, are you afraid of heights? And I thought, oh, my God, where's he going to send me? And he sent me to the mall. It was a little two-story building. I said, man, no, I'm not afraid of heights.
Yeah.
But I thought, like at the time, I thought, Jesus Christ, you want to send me to the top of the Eiffel Tower?
Yeah.
but then work kind of slowed down. We had some tough times. And that's it.
He's done an amazing job as far as, you know, passing the executive order where it's going to require a PLA on federal projects over $35 million. That's huge. I mean, you know, it's a...
And, you know, the iron workers themselves, they'll struggle through, but they got a wife. And that wife is just as much of the iron worker as he is.
Yeah.
They put up with the bullshit. They put up with the pickets. They put up with the bad weather. They put up with the injuries. And they stick by them.
Yeah.
So,
you know, yeah. Wife is, my wife is super supportive, on everything. You know, I wouldn't be here without her. You know what I mean? I'm sure that's, is that, you know, your wife the same way? I would assume, like you just said, she's basically an iron worker and she just knows what it is.
You know, I was married to her for 62 years and she finally passed away, but she stood by me all the time. And a lot of the times I would quit because I was pissed off at something, you know?
the big jobs that you were able to work on, Bill, when you got to Portland, you know, as you established yourself here and stuff, you know, did you get to work on any of the big story jobs? I mean, was there any story jobs you got to work on when you got here?
Yeah, I can't think of anything in particular. I worked at Camus.
Camus. Did you continue to just stay like welding at that time, or you just took whatever you had?
I took whatever I
yeah.
had.
Yeah.
I'm not a Rodman.
Yeah.
They don't know. You don't want to hire me out of the rod buster. I suck. Yeah. But any kind of structural work.
Yeah.
But the best job I had was at Trojan, at the nuclear facility.
Trojan.
I was up there for quite a while.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that this was ironwork, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was there when Mount St. Helens erupted.
Wow.
So they didn't lay anybody off. They wanted to keep everybody because it was difficult to get people up there.
Yeah.
Because they told, you know, well, you don't get any travel pay. I thought, I don't care. It's inside.
Yeah.
You know, if it's raining, I'm still going to get my 8 hours.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I was there quite a while.
So at what point did you start realizing that you wanted to be an apprenticeship instructor? I mean, was that just something that you wanted to do, or it just kind of like fell on your life? Somebody asked you, hey, Bill, you want to be what do you think about instructing?
Frank Kuzma, who was another great, great guy, said that I saw him in a bar, and he said, look at this. And he showed me a card, and it was a certified welding inspector. I thought, man, how did you get that? I'd love to have that. He said, well, I'm going to give some courses on Saturday, but there's only room for like 10 guys or 12 guys. So if you're going to do this, you got to show up every Saturday. I said, okay, yeah, I'll do it. So I went through that schooling, and I took this certified welder's exam and passed.
Wow.
It was the hardest test I've ever taken in my life, but I passed, just passed, but I passed. And so he said, hey, if you want, you can come down here on Saturday and help me teach the welding. I said, yeah, sure. And I come down for 3 or 4 Saturdays, and he handed me a check. I said, what's this? He said, well, I'm getting paid. I said, I didn't know I was getting paid. I was just coming down here, you know, to help out.
Yeah.
And then finally he said, would you like to be an apprentice instructor? I said, well, I don't know, Frank. I don't know if I'm good enough. He said, oh, you're fine. You'll do fine. So he hired me as a first-year apprentice instructor, basically safety.
Yeah.
That's basically what I taught. And then when he moved out and Lee moved in, Lee decided to keep me. And so that's how it happened. I never really had planned on being an instructor.
Yeah.
It just kind of fell in place.
Fell in place. No, I've, you know, a lot of guys I've talked to, you know, they said they remember you being their first year apprenticeship teacher and just, you know, absolutely thought you were thought the greatest of you. So that was just a huge thing. And just kind of, did you like teaching? I mean, as you got into it, did you actually enjoy it?
Yeah. I liked it. I tell them the first day, don't worry about failing. We got you.
Yeah.
You ain't getting away. And they were good kids, and they're pretty smart kids. I know that Joe Bowers is one of my first-year apprentices. I knew immediately that Joe Bowers was going to be something.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was a little bit different. He was more at ease around the men, you know? Yeah.
So you just kind of knew you could just see that in them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You could tell, who was going to be the foreman and who was going to be the worker, who might go into politics. You listen to what they'd say and, you know, you'd say, okay, this kid, he's got some good ideas.
Yeah.
He's going to have a hard time getting there because he's going to have opposition.
Yes.
But, you can tell.
Yeah. So, retired from, Bill, did you?
Yeah.
You retired from being, you know, as?
Yeah. We weren't full-time. We were full-time for the class, but we weren't like a 12-month a year instructor. We came in. I was working at Trojan, and I told Lee, yes, I'll come down and teach a class. And Lee said, well, you know, we've only got one class. And I said, that's okay. And I told him at Trojan, they said, well, look, if you leave, you know, we can't bring you back.
Yeah.
I said, hey, I don't care. I've got one master, and that's the union.
Yep.
I told them I would teach this class.
Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah.
Well, they lied. I taught the class, and about 3 months later, they got in touch with me and had me come back to Trojan.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you can only have one.
Being an iron worker and then being a leader, as far as, you know, you start as a hand, and then you become a foreman, and then you know, hopefully work up to being a GF and then maybe a superintendent. Like, what was your mindset as far as, like, you know, at what point did you want to start, you know, being a foreman and a GF and a superintendent? I mean, did you enjoy doing that, or did you just kind of had got, hey,
I never wanted to be a foreman.
No,
I never wanted to be a foreman. I didn't want to be a leader. I did what I thought was right for me. And what I thought was right for me, I thought was right for the rest of the gang. Just give me my job. Let me do my job. Stay away, and I'll do my job. If I'm doing it wrong, come tell me, and I'll correct it. But just leave me alone. And then I believe it was a Trojan. Maybe it was a Camus, that I got my first foreman's job. And I'd tell the crew right off the bat, listen, if you've got a better idea than me, you bring it forward. I'm just a guy. I'm not some kind of a god. I don't know everything. Matter of fact, I know a little bit of things. And I think they appreciated that. We always worked together as a crew. I never felt that I was superior to anybody in any way. And they're iron workers. No, I'm sorry. The first foreman's job I had was at a nuclear power plant in South Jersey. I was in charge of a crew that was putting rebar into a wall. And this nuclear power plant was in a swamp. And when I went down to tie the rods, the mosquitoes were so thick that they come climbing out. They said, we're not going down there. I said, well, don't go down there. Just sit here. So they all sat down. About 20 minutes later, the general foreman come by and said, what's going on? I said, hey, there's mosquitoes in there. The guys ain't going to go in there. So another 10 minutes here, they come with cans and cans and cans of mosquito spray.
Wow.
So they had the mosquito spray.
Yeah.
But they didn't give it to us, you know?
Yeah.
Until the guy said, we ain't going in there. And the general foreman said, well, tell them men to get back in there. I said, I'm not telling them to get back in there. There's a million mosquitoes in there. So I enjoyed doing that. But as far as trying to tell the men, you know, hurry up, do this, do that. No, they're iron workers.
What's your thinking on the trade nowadays? I mean, what do you see?
I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think it's great that they have women. It was difficult to have women in the 50s and 60s because there was no OSHA. You had to climb the columns. You had to carry the bottles of oxygen, bottles of acetylene. You know how heavy a bottle of acetylene?
Yeah.
But somehow we did it. I did it because the guy in front of me did it. And he did it because the guy in front of him did it.
Yeah. Amazing hands. I mean, we got some great apprentices coming up, and we got some, you know, of our veteran women journeymen. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're just great hands. You know, they're a great asset to our local, I believe.
Yeah, the first group of women that I had was the first-year apprentices. And I would tell them, look, you're going to be an iron worker. Learn to weld. I know you think you're strong and all, and I know you are, but you're not going to want to do this at 45 years old.
Yeah.
You know, learn to weld. And some of them did, and some of them became damn good welders. The first good welder I saw was a pipe fitter, and she was out in Boardman when they put up the Boardman plant. And man, it was like a painting.
Yeah.
The woman could weld, you know, stainless steel. And so that's when I said, hey, these women can weld. We need welders. We can use women welders. Why not?
Yeah. What about as far as like, you know, minority people, Bill? I mean, what was, you know, as far as having, you know, brothers of color and, you know, and that kind of thing, what was it like?
They didn't have any colored in the structural local when I was back there. They would send them to the rod local. Very prejudiced.
Yeah.
My father was born in Tennessee, so you can imagine.
Yes.
But very prejudiced. I wasn't, you know.
No, that's what's great about Local 29 is that we're just, we're super diverse. I mean,
yeah.
I think we're one of the most diverse locals around, yeah, to be honest with you.
And I would tell the guys and the girls, it doesn't matter what color you are, what ethnic group you come from. If you're a man or a woman, you're a punk and you're green.
Yeah.
And you got to change that color green and become a journeyman.
Yep.
And I tell the guys, you see a girl, a man and a girl, usually means romance,
yeah,
or sexual attraction, but not here.
Yeah.
Because you're going to depend on that woman for your life.
Absolutely.
At some point during the week.
Absolutely. Know? Obviously, the world, we're in a different time and things like that, you know, and, you know, I think that since we're so diverse and, you know, the way Local 29 is, I mean, we have a lot of growing to do, obviously. I mean, we can always get better and improve and all that. But I truly believe that, you know, we're going to be the leader. I mean, you know, Jason was just talking about it the other day. Just, you know, we're kind of ahead of everybody. And but, you know, the world's obviously changing and things like that. You know, you got people that are transgender and gay and things like that. You know, but I believe, you know, everybody has a place and, you know, I think we're more welcoming than most people, you know what I mean? Oh, most, yeah, locals. So, yeah. As far as that, Bill, I mean, like, where do you see our trade heading at some point right now? You know, it's, you know, we have a lot of obviously tools that make our jobs a lot easier, but and all that, but do you see kind of like, where do you see ironworking going in the next 20 years?
It'll basically be the same. It's, you know, they have machines that can do certain things, but they don't have machines that can bowl up. They don't have machines that can do the things that ironworkers have to do. So it's going to be the same. And until they come up with a different type of a building material that they can make an apartment building in a factory someplace,
yeah,
they're going to have to be ironworkers.
Yeah,
and it's going to be hard physical work. It's hard physical work. Iron is not light.
Unionism and politics, Bill.
I believe that there's Democrats who gave us Social Security. Lyndon Johnson opened up a whole bunch of civil rights things. And then there's Republicans. And the Republicans believe that might makes right, that if you have the money, you can hire people and you can put people to work and you can pay them and they should be thankful to you for that. But you shouldn't be thankful to them for making you rich.
Yeah.
You know? I'm a Democrat. I'll die a Democrat. If I see somebody needing help, I'll help them. And so will the Republican. But when it comes to business, when it comes to making money, they're worried about the stock market. I'm worried about the grocery store. You know, I want to make sure that I have enough money to pay my rent next month. I could not be friends with a Republican. Their way of looking at things and my way of looking at things are totally different. I'm happy with a roof over my head, food in my refrigerator, automobile, health care for my family. You know, they want more. Greed. Greed is a human condition. Everybody has it. If you look at a kid, a two-year-old kid, if you put two of them on the floor and you put two pieces of candy down there, a big piece of candy and a small piece of candy, the Republican's kid's going to pick the big piece of candy and let you have the small piece of candy. And if you don't eat it quick enough, he'll take that too.
Yeah.
So I just don't understand where they're at. In my opinion, they are the ones that thought that in the American Revolution, the king was right. You know?
Yep.
And I feel, no, the king wasn't right.
So, no, absolutely. But yeah, just kind of winding down here, Bill. I mean, the last thing I have here on my points is just a closing message to future ironworkers. What would you leave? What message would you give to the next generation of ironworkers coming up?
If you're an apprentice, I would say listen to your instructors. These are not just bum ironworkers that haven't got anything else to do. They're instructors. They're teaching you. They have been to classes and they have studied and they want to do good for you. Don't argue with them. Listen to what they have to say. If you have questions, ask the questions. They'll give you an answer. If they don't have it immediately, they'll find it for you. And realize when you get into this that it sucks. I don't care what OSHA does for you. I don't care what the union does for you. When it rains and it's 42 degrees outside, and you're sitting on an iron beam, it sucks. So be prepared for that. Understand that it's a good pay. Yeah, good pay. Great pay. Good benefits. Fantastic benefits. Last year, I had over $200,000 in medical bills. My portion of that so far has been $40. My health insurance took care of the rest. So, along with the benefits, understand that it's a very, very difficult job. You got to be smart. You can't be dumb. Listen to your instructors. Pay attention to where you're at. Pay attention to your partner. And stay away from your partner. If you're two of you working up on the iron, stay away from him. You don't have to be up his ass. If something happens to him, if you're up his ass, it's going to happen to you too. Stay away. Don't be the first one to run out and try to fix something. Look at the situation. Understand it. And pay attention to safety. Safety.
I think this is super important. It's just to document your experiences as well as everybody else's retirees kind of thing, you know, just kind of, I want the current ironworkers and, you know, the next generation to have something to go back and listen to what it was like. And when we didn't have it as easy as we do.
Yeah. Well, take what I said with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Everything I've said is true. And, I wish everybody the best of luck in this trade. It's a good trade. It's a tough trade, but you'll find good friends and a good life if you stay healthy.
Yep. All right, Bill. Well, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
That's a wrap on this one, brothers and sisters. Keep an ear open for the next episode and be safe.